Carm Capriotto here, and my guest is Mitch Snyder. Now, I wanted to know, when did Mitch Snyder realize he had important things to say, and what were the series of events that led to his legacy as one of our industry's most important leaders?
And a lot of people who find themselves in business don't want to confront the necessary process and systems involved in running a successful business and being able to say no. Learning how to say no is the hardest and the most liberating thing I've ever accomplished in business.
Welcome, aftermarketers, to Remarkable Results Radio. Listen to learn just one thing from today's episode on your journey to remarkable results. Carm Capriotto here, and truly honored to interview legacy aftermarket leader Mitch Snyder. Now, I'm 100% positive you've read a Mitch Snyder article because he's written for most every aftermarket magazine. You may have attended one of Mitch's classes over the years as he forged out of his California base to help show shop owners how to become more profitable. You may even have heard Mitch speak at so many industry events. Hey, just before we get to Mitch's interview, I want to remind you that Remarkable Results Radio is proud to partner with Napa Auto Care in the upcoming 2020 Napa Expo. Join Napa in Las Vegas April 6th through 9th, write that down, 2020, to discover the latest innovations in the auto care industry. This is an event you don't want to miss. Contact your Napa store to get involved and to learn more. Hey, are you subscribed to a mobile smart device listening app? Well, it's so easy to listen to the Aftermarket's Business Talk podcasts. Now, if you're new to podcasts, welcome. If you're looking for a great way to listen mobile, go to remarkableresults.biz/app. There are over 12 apps listed there for you to get involved. And the website itself is stock full of great content like the books page, photos page, and many ways to filter the content you specifically need to hear. Hey, find the talking points for Mitch Snyder's interview at remarkableresults.biz/E415. Okay, so you know Mitch Snyder. He is truly a legacy icon of our industry, and he's dedicated his life to run a great shop for decades and at the same time write and speak to help our industry grow. There isn't an issue that he hasn't tackled where his reader could take his wisdom and improve themselves and their business. Now, one thing I wanted to know from Mitch is, how did it all start? Now, if you're a Mitch Snyder fan or follower, you may not know this story. You'll hear how Mitch found his stride and passion for helping the industry by writing and speaking on industry challenges and solutions. Coming up is a very transparent and personal discussion with Mitch in a way that you may have never heard before. He is also sharing with you his biggest challenge of his life to date and his extreme confidence in his total recovery. It is in his nature to win. Hey, a warm welcome to Mitch Snyder. Mitch, oh, for 4 years, I've wanted to do an interview with you.
And here I am.
And here you are. Wow, foremost author, trainer, speaker, shop owner, an individual who unselfishly shared his wisdom to the entire industry, you know, writing about how you see things. And I have to tell you something, I've read you for years, and how you saw things, Mitch, was so much how I saw things.
You know, I have a relationship. I had, for years, I had a coach involved in a coaching consulting company that I'm very close to. For years, we had our Thursday morning phone call at 9 o'clock, and we still do. even though I've been out of the shop for 2 years, every Thursday morning at 9 o'clock, we still get together. And he probably told me one of the most beautiful things I've heard in a long time. And it's along the same lines of what you just said. He said, I'd go into work in the morning, I'd go into the restroom, which is where they keep the magazines. And because I've said for years, I'm the best restroom reader there is. And in an automotive repair shop anyway. And he said, he'd pick up the magazine and he'd read my column first. He said, because I wrote from the heart and because it touched his own. And that meant so much to me this morning. It was a great way to start the day.
Absolutely true. You have written from the heart. Where did you get your content? Was it like you were living and breathing and working in the shop and being exposed by all the elements in our industry? And were those ideas just percolated from everything that went on inside Mitch's world? Oh, isn't that funny to say Mitch's world? Yes.
A moment of truth. in the spirit of full disclosure, in the early 1980s, I had been doing this since 1966. I've been a professional technician since 1966. And I had worked diligently to become the best mechanic technician I could be. And was succeeding, I think. I was a good mechanic and a good technician. They are different, and we can discuss that at a later date. Sure. or later in the interview, but they are different skill sets.
Well, wait a minute. Can I stop you there for a moment? I love the idea that we can do this again. Are you good with that?
Oh, yeah. I'm counting on it.
Oh, good. All right. Okay.
I'm counting on it.
I got your commitment right on. Go ahead.
A company called Bear Automotive Equipment Company, back in the old days, you remember Bear Alignment?
I do.
And they went into the engine performance business with an analyzer that was backed actually by Chevron Oil. Chevron wanted a way to computerize records and to send them to the mothership so that they would be available wherever you as a client traveled, so that your records would be there when you, let's say you were traveling across country. And as long as you went to a Chevron branded station, you would have your records there. So they bankrolled the Bear ACE computer, ACE.
Okay.
Computerized equipment. And through an equipment salesman, I found out about this and started really beating the equipment salesman up to get more information about this computerized engine analyzer, because it would do everything that a regular analyzer would do, but it was digital. It wasn't analog. And we were the first shop outside of a branded Chevron station that had an ACE computer. And when we got it, we realized it did so much more than we were told it was going to do. We were told that it would do so much more than we were aware that they were aware it would do. And we wound up calling up Wisconsin constantly telling them, did you know if you use the temperature probe on the exhaust manifold, you could find a bad diesel injector? And did you know if you did this, this would happen? And the screen that you have, the multi-screen that you have, isn't really adequate. You need to show RPM. You need to show this. You need to show that. You need to. And we were on the phone with them. I was on the phone with them 2 to 3 times a week, and got to really know the product manager really, really well, and who in turn, you know, worked for the vice president of whatever. In any case, there's a group in the industry called the Equipment and Tool Industry, Tool Institute, ETI.
Yep.
It's like the United Laboratories of our industry. If anybody's going to be old enough to understand this, if you wanted to build a dwell meter, that's so absurd. If you wanted to build a dwell meter, they would tell you what you had to do so that whatever product you came up with would be considered a dwell meter. And ETI has, at that time, used to bring in an industry person, a repair community person, who would give a state of the industry message. And they had somebody planned for that year's event. And whoever it was decided they couldn't or wouldn't or weren't able to do the event. And at the last minute, my friend Tom Fudali called me up and he said, we have this opportunity for you to speak at the Equipment and Tool Institute. We'd love to come and have you give a state of the industry message. Is that something that you would do? And I'm one of these people that will always say yes first and then think about what I just agreed to later.
Yeah, so I know how that feels.
I said, yeah, I'll do it. Now, here's the backstory. The backstory was, this is 1984. My son was born in 1974. My daughter was born in 1978. I knew at that point that my son was bright and he was going to go. We told both kids from the beginning, there was no option. They were going to go to school. They were going to have, you know, post-high school education. I didn't care what it was, but they were going to go to school. And it just drove me nuts that on what I was making as a professional automotive repair technician, dealing with other people's safety in their lives, I would never be able to send my son or my daughter to schools that they were capable of attending because I just didn't make enough money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would just be impossible to do that. And so I was angry. There's this undercurrent of anger that more or less permeated everything I was doing at that particular point in my life. And they asked me to make this speech. And I said, well, what do you want me to speak about? And they said, the state of the industry. And I said, well, that's a pretty broad topic. What do you? And they never told me. And they never told me what I couldn't speak on. And what they did tell me, it's God's honest truth, what they did tell me was that they didn't expect very much because, after all, I was a technician. You know, so just get up there and tell them what you're going to tell them. Well, because they didn't tell me what I said, how long am I up there for? And they said, well, you're up there for 55 minutes. So I figured they wanted a 55-minute speech. So I wrote a 55-minute speech entitled, Give Me Your Tired and Broken Cars. And it was a laundry list of everything that was wrong with the industry. Stereotypes, stigma, lack of adequate compensation, lack of respect, lack of standards, lack of generally accepted standards within our industry sure. for what a technician really is and what they should be paid. Lack of mandatory classroom education. I mean, the whole nine yards. And it was, I didn't know it was 30 minutes with 20 minutes of questions and answers.
By the way, if anyone has followed Mitch and you're with him in this story at this current moment, you know where this is going. I love this.
So in my frustration and in my anger, I went ahead and wrote a 55-minute diatribe on everything that was wrong with the industry because nobody would tell me not to.
You got it off your chest.
It was cathartic. It was an amazing experience.
Yeah,
just the writing of it was, and I wrote it on it. If anybody's old enough to know this, I wrote it on an old military spec K-Pro CPM computer.
Oh my.
Portable computer and WordStar.
Oh, which I'm not sure. I remember. I used WordStar.
Mm. That's what I started with.
Wow.
And when I realized that you could actually write something and then cut it up and paste it and put it back together again without erasing it, it became therapeutic. And I got all of this off my chest. And at one point, I turned to my wife. I said, I'm going to call him up and tell him I'm not going to do this. I said, Leslie, I'm going to tell him I can't do this. And she said, why? And I said, well, what if they don't like it? What if they don't like what I have to tell them? What if they don't listen? And she says, what do you care? I said, what do you mean, what do I care? She said, what do you care? You want to, you're, what are they going to do? Come and take the shop away? If they did, you'd find something else to do. What are you worried about? And that gave me whatever little prodding I needed to complete the speech.
Good for her.
I still believe I go back every once in a while and I read it again and mourn the fact that so little has changed. That we're facing the same problems that we were facing in 1984. I neglected to ask Tom or Russ Bailey, the vice president at the time. I forgot to ask them who was going to be there. I forgot to ask them how many people would be there. And when I finally did ask them, they said, well, he said, they're going to be the people representing the big three manufacturers. Now think about how long ago we're talking about when the big three manufacturers, Ford, Chrysler, GM.
Yep.
They're going to be, all of the trade publications are going to be there and representatives of most of the who's who in the automotive equipment industry. And I almost had a baby. I got up. I don't know how I did it. I practiced the speech, even put a joke in there. So people, and I started delivering the speech. And it was exactly 55 minutes long, which caused lunch to be late. I was the last one on before lunch.
Always a tough place.
It's everybody wants to get the hell out of there. And I was terrified because it was my first experience public speaking. It was my first experience public speaking, period. I don't think high school counts.
So how old were you, Mitch? Maybe in your 40s, 30s?
In my 30s.
Okay.
I'm trying to think. I was... 34. I'm doing the math in my head, but I was in my 30s. There were hundreds of people in the room. I don't even know how many. And I was scared to death when I got up there. God bless my wife. She bought me a dark suit.
So they couldn't see you sweat.
Yeah. So if I had been wearing a light suit, it would have been all over. It was so quiet, Carm. It was eerily quiet. People laughed at the joke, but it was so insanely quiet. I finished the speech, said thank you, backed away from the podium, and it was dead quiet. And all of a sudden, you heard a, and then more people started to clap, and more people started to clap, and then everybody just stood up. I got a standing ovation, which didn't mean, it really didn't mean anything to me at the time because I didn't appreciate what a Maslow moment that was.
Yeah.
But after the speech, I had people walking up to me and asking me different questions about this or that or the other thing. And the same question that you started this interview with is, how did you become you? And that was pretty much how I became me. And then I was asked to give that speech 7 times that year. In the next 12 months, 7 times, I gave it to Union Oil. I spoke for Dana Corporation. I spoke for a bunch of other people and places.
Hey, Carm here to highlight why the NAPA Auto Care Program may be right for you. Let's talk about warranties. How long do you warranty your repairs or services for your customers? Does your warranty cover your customers anywhere in the country? Now, if you're a NAPA Auto Care Center, you have confidence in knowing your customers are covered for 24 months or 24,000 miles nationwide. Now, that's because one of the many benefits of the NAPA Auto Care Program is the Nationwide Peace of Mind Warranty. The Nationwide Peace of Mind Warranty provides the best coverage in the industry, and it allows your shop to compete with other national brands. It's a written warranty that is honored at more than 17,000 NAPA Auto Care Center locations from Florida to California and everywhere in between. Wow, 17,000 locations. That's more than any other automotive repair brand. When you're part of the NAPA Auto Care Program, no matter where your customers travel, if they experience a problem with a covered repair, they can count on NAPA Auto Care to be nearby to get them back on the road. The Nationwide Peace of Mind Warranty covers parts and labor on qualifying repairs and services for 24 months or 24,000 miles. And the warranty claim process is easy, too. If you're ready to give your customers the security and confidence of a nationwide warranty and provide them with peace of mind, knowing that they are receiving a quality repair or service, especially if they're unable to return to you for warranty, then NAPA Auto Care may be right for you. Contact your local NAPA Auto Parts store today and learn more about the Nationwide Peace of Mind Warranty and the hundreds of other reasons to become part of the NAPA Auto Care family, the largest network of independent automotive repair shops in the country. So you did your first speech. You said you did 7 to 9 of them that year, but your first one with the ETI, resounding applause, then you get the second and the third. When did you realize that your message was so strong? Was it the first or by the time you got into it in your fifth or sixth?
I'm not sure that I ever did, Carm, in all honesty. I knew it was a message that the industry needed to hear, but realistically, I never internalized it as my message, so I'm not sure. What I did learn from writing the speech was that if I wrote about things that happened in the shop, I wasn't as angry as I had been before I wrote the speech. And I realized that if I wrote about it somewhat objectively, but personally, because it was more like a journal, like a personal journal, than it was like the columns that I had read in the magazines myself all these years, I realized that I felt better as a person. And I was in Corpus Christi, delivering that to, and I don't even remember who it was to. And we were in the Corpus Christi airport, which at the time was tiny. I don't know if they've rebuilt it or not, but it was a really small local airport. And I was sitting at a table with another person that had attended the conference that I really didn't know. And I went to open my briefcase, and I carried a regular old style briefcase. And I went to open my briefcase, and literally the briefcase fell off the table, and all of these little vignettes fell out. There was a whole bunch of them. There were 6 or 7 that I had written. And the fellow helped me put them all together, and then he took 2 of them, and he started to thumb through them. And I said, I said, that's my stuff. And he said, I know, I'm looking at it. And I said, that's my stuff. Give it back to me. It's personal. It's not your stuff. It's not for general consumption. He said, that's my stuff.
My stuff.
That was my stuff. I wrote that stuff.
Did you ever hear the routine from George Carlin about your stuff?
Yes, I did. That's pretty much where that came from. It's my stuff. You know, it's my stuff is stuff. Your stuff is not, you know. And he said, well, don't you want to know if it's good stuff or not? And I said, well, what do you mean, don't I want to know if it's good stuff or not? And he said, well, don't you want to know if it's good? I said, I don't know what good means. And he said, well, don't you know whether it's worth somebody else reading? And I said, how are you going to tell me that? And he said, well, my name is Fred Gotze, and I'm the editor of Motor Service Magazine. And he says, and why don't you give me a few of these and let me take a look at it? And I'll let you know whether it's good stuff or not. And at that point in time, I realized that I might have something to say that somebody else might be interested in listening to, and something important, something that could change the industry. Now, at that time, I was naive enough to think that we could do that faster than trying to move the Titanic. Fred let me know that the stuff was good enough to print, and they made me an offer, and I got an offer for Motor Age at the same time. And the offer, this again, I'm too dumb to lie. I would never remember the story. So I was terrified of writing for Motor Age because it would have meant writing for Stan Stevenson. And he scared the hell out of me. I think he scared the hell out of everybody. I took the job with Motor Service and wrote for them for 11 years before going to Motor Age and working for Tony Mola, who was the editor for about 3.5 minutes, long enough to hire me and then leave. I've been really fortunate. I've worked for the best publishing companies in the industry, including Motor Age and Babcock, the Babcock's books, which was one of the best experiences of my life. I really think that is such a fine organization. And now for Ratchet and Wrench, yeah, which is totally focused on the things that I'm passionate about, which is leadership and management in the industry.
Yeah. You bring up the word Stan Stevenson. That name so flashed in front of me because I had an article or two done on me back in my day, and I swear it was Stan Stevenson who either interviewed me over the phone or something like that, but a respected industry professional from the media side.
He was an industry icon.
Yeah.
And as much of a curmudgeon as anybody who remembers Andy Rooney, he was to our industry what Andy Rooney was to broadcast. But he was brutally honest. I mean, he was insightful and brutally honest, and there are a lot of lessons there.
Yeah. I so appreciate this story. I think our listener is going to say, oh, I had no idea. It was like when I interviewed Gonzo, and he told the story of how he got his nickname, you know, and now we hear your story of how it all came to be. And I love the story in the airport.
The whole beginning of my career was incredibly serendipitous. I mean, it defies, I don't think you could have planned it. I don't think you could have made it happen. I was just really fortunate to have the right message for the right group at the right time, and got enough interest. And I would love to think in some way I've managed to influence the industry. I know when I started writing, there were probably three of us, perhaps, that were writing about the industry, Bob Cirillo, myself, and I can't think of anybody else. So maybe there were just two of us. And now we've created a cottage industry where there are lots of people that are writing about their experience in the industry.
And it's necessary. It's needed. You know, Mitch, the A players, the top 10%ers, I don't know. I hate to stereotype, but someone in a box. You and I were chatting, and you had told me, man, we've got to get out there and help the rest of the players in the industry get better. And that's what you've been doing for your whole life. And, you know, has the message gotten through? Are you satisfied that some of the stuff that you did really made a difference?
I don't know if satisfied is the right word. I'm encouraged okay. that I see changes in the industry. I'm not satisfied because it hasn't gotten far enough, fast enough yet. I still see so many people struggling to make a living in such a vitally important trade. I've been through so many changes. We've gone through electronic ignition and active suspension to computerized electronic ignition to 65% of the vehicle's content being computerized. And everybody keeps thinking that somehow magically we're going to become superfluous or unnecessary somehow. And yet I don't see that happening in any time in the future. And to have a workforce that's technically competent and service oriented, customer focused, customer centric is so important. And it's encouraging to see the people who have gotten that message, whose businesses are blossoming, but it's depressing as hell to go, you know, to go around the country and see how many shops are open at 8 or 9 o'clock on a Friday night after the day is finished, still working on cars because their productivity or their technician efficiency or their operating systems just don't work and, you know, aren't adequate.
So why hasn't the onslaught of webinars, articles being written, seminars being produced and given online, leader-led, far enough and fast enough, you said? Why hasn't this shaken the core?
Because those of us that have devoted our lives to making this happen, you among them, are talking to the same people all the time. We're talking to the same people all the time. If we go to church every Sunday and we look around the room and the same faces are there, and they're hungry for the knowledge, and they absorb everything that you can give them. They ask you challenging questions, and they give you hope. And it's that third tier, that second tier of shop owners that are out there that know there's something wrong, but they don't know what it is. They're so terrified of success or change in that direction because they have no idea how their lives are going to change if they achieve that kind of success, that they're willing to go ahead and endure the pain and the frustration of where they are rather than break out.
You know, Mitch, they got into business because they had a vision of that success, and now they can't achieve it.
I don't know if vision, you know, Carm, I don't know if vision's the right word. They had a perception that there was a different reality out there.
Okay.
And maybe they'd seen other shops where the shop owner was in quote successful, whatever that means to them. And they figured if the chubby guy in the office was smart enough to run his own business, then certainly they could. You know, the entrepreneurial seizure that Michael Gerber wrote about in The E-Myth. Then all of a sudden they went out on their own and they realized that it isn't anything like what they thought it was going to be. And the terror of leaving people behind, the terror of losing relationships is paralyzing.
Mitch, it's not humility or ego that holds them back. It's terror.
I think terror can take many shapes and forms. And I think that I don't think it's humility at all.
Well, they need to find humility in order to move over that line. I mean, I
think that's really true. And I think there's a certain amount of hubris that gets in the way.
Yep.
I'm the best technician that is or ever was or ever will be. I can fix anything. You know, I said for years, it didn't matter how, you know, it didn't matter whether or not you could do the best brake job that anybody's ever done in the history of our industry. If you didn't get paid for it, and you couldn't make a living doing that brake job, you wouldn't be able to do it for very long. So you've got to be able to reconcile the business side of being in business, the mechanics of being in business, all right, against the technical aspect of being able to do whatever it is that we do every day. And a lot of people who find themselves in business don't want to confront the necessary process and systems involved in running a successful business and being able to say no. Learning how to say no was the hardest and the most liberating thing I've ever accomplished in business. No, I'm sorry, we can do that, but we choose not to. You know, if we can't make any money doing that, then there's no reason for us to do it. And that's why I think that this sense of ego that says, I can do it, and I'm going to prove that I can do it, no matter how much money it costs me, and, you know, no matter how much I put my family and my business at risk, but I'm going to prove that I can fix this car. That's the car that's been to every other shop in town unsuccessfully and alienated every other shop owner in town. And then all of a sudden it shows up at your door and you say, yeah, I can fix it. Well, there's a reason everybody else threw him out. I think about this all the time. I've been retired for 2 years. I still write for the industry.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me how being involved outside the industry can still give you enough insight about the way the world works to remain relevant, which was my great fear when I retired, is that I would cease to be relevant.
Well, first of all, thank you for continuing what you're doing. Doesn't seem like you're retired as much as you think you are, as you know, go back to the ETI speech, but I'm constantly in the industry, taking my studio out, doing keynotes and moderating panels, and so many people that I know that I've interviewed have said, if there's anything I could do for anyone, please. And I was just recently away for this past weekend. Someone came up to me and says, hey, give me a few podcasts I can listen to solve, quote unquote, this issue. And I said, I'll even do you one better. I know someone who's an A player, and I don't want to put anybody in a box, that'd be more than happy to talk to you. If that seems to be a sense that I have about people willing to give, will the A players really need to drag the B players over the line? And if they can, how do we do it?
I'm not sure about dragging them over the line. It would be important. It would be important for people that have, even for people that are on the road to success, the people that have broken those chains and started to move towards success, or the people that have achieved a higher level of success, because we're all insatiable when it comes to better, more, larger. I think it's a matter of extending a hand and saying, hey, I see you, you know, namaste. I see you. I see the pain you're in. I see how hard you're trying. Or maybe even not. You know, I can see where you are because that's where I was. Why don't you just reach out, grab my hand, and let me help you? You know, if you have questions, ask them. Let me come down and watch your business for a day or 2 days. And perhaps I can go ahead and give you one or two pointers that'll get you started on this road enough so that you will see that there's another reality, enough so that you can see that you have choices, enough so that you can see that you're not stuck in this really deep rut that's now become a chasm, become a valley, and you can't climb out.
Well, you know, that's my metaphor of dragging over the line is exactly what you described. Thank you for fixing that for me. Exactly right. Mitch, thanks for helping me understand where you came from and how you got where you got. Has all of that prepared you for the challenge you face right now?
I think everything that you go through in life, everything that you experience in life, everything that you feel in life prepares you for wherever you are if you are in touch or in tune enough with your inner self to take advantage of whatever those strengths are and in order to combat whatever weaknesses you have. You know, you and I have talked in the past privately about where I am in my particular challenge. I have a very, very rare blood cancer. It's called primary myelofibrosis, probably one of 17 or 18, less than 20,000 people in the whole country that have this disease. First question that my hematologist oncologist asked me in the first interview that we had together was, did you ever work with any heavy metals, petrochemicals, or solvents? I'm the fourth generation of my family in this business. I've been working around that stuff since I was 2 years old. So yeah, the answer is yes. It's a very it's the triumvirate. It's incurable, untreatable, and terminal. Without a bone marrow transplant, which is about what I'm about to embark upon right now, it's got a very, very ugly prognosis, and the symptoms are not pleasant. And I'm fortunate enough so that I'm strong enough and healthy enough that my doctors believe that I'll be able to survive the transplant process. I'm not done yet. there's more to do. There's more on the plate. There's stuff on the plate I haven't tasted yet.
Yeah.
You know, there are desserts I haven't eaten. We just found out Saturday night last that I'm going to be a grandpa again. So it'll be my fourth grandchild, and I'm not ready to walk away from any of that stuff. I think to a large degree, every challenge that I have ever encountered in my life that I've managed to meet and beat is preparing me for the mental toughness it's going to take to go through this process. And I'm really looking forward to, you know, I just had my psych evaluation. Nobody was more surprised than I that I got through it. I thought for sure I was going to go ahead and lose that one.
What were they asking you?
Oh, they were all kinds of questions about where you are in your life, how you relate to your disease. How do you think you're going to get through it? What about the other people in your life? What are your fears? What are your aspirations? You know, and I thought for sure I was going to tank the whole thing.
Wait a minute. If you tanked it, what would it have made a difference if you would have?
If they don't think you're psychologically prepared for the ugliness that's coming,
yeah,
they won't allow you to begin. I'm going to start out with 5 days of conditioning chemotherapy, chemicals not pleasant, lots of ugly side effects, to prepare me for another round of chemo, the point of both of which is to kill my immune system so that it'll allow the new stem cells to grow without being attacked by the body and destroyed. And the bone marrow, my bone marrow, which has betrayed me, through a chemical, you know, through a microscopic molecular mutation, to get rid of that as well, so that the new stem cells can take root. I'll be in isolation for 30 days because of the fact that my immune system is destroyed. After I'm released from the hospital 30 days post-transplant, I have to go to we're going to be living remotely for 4 months out by the City of Hope in Duarte, California, which is 65 miles from where we live, because I can't be more than 15 minutes away from the hospital, to put it as my doctor put it much more succinctly than I could, because bad things can happen very quickly. So you have to be within 15 minutes. And we're going to be doing that for 100 days before they release me to come home and only go back and forth to the hospital once a week for clinic. If you're not prepared for that psychologically, if you're not prepared for the isolation, if you're not prepared for the frustration and pain, for, you know, for the sickness, for the all of the side effects, then you're not going to make it. And you've got to have a really strong why.
I'm hearing that isolation piece has got to be, you know, something you've thought long and hard about.
Well, I'm mildly social.
No kidding.
I'll be able to have visitors, but only on a very limited basis. And this is going to be the first time since my wife and I are married that we're going to be essentially, you know, separated for the 30 days where I'll be in the hospital. I know other people have gone through this. I know there are people in service whose families are left to survive, to thrive in their absence.
Mm-hmm.
But this is our first experience with that. So,
how many years you been married?
Going to be 49.
Never been apart.
So I'm not looking forward to that. I haven't seen my grandkids in 2 months. I have, you know, my grandkids are or three, you know, up to five, three, four, and five. Mm-hmm. And they all go to preschool. And the first thing the doctor said to me was, don't you dare go near your grandkids. Your white count is destroyed because of the disease, and your immune system won't be able to handle it. You know, somebody else will catch a cold. You'll wind up with pneumonia. I'm not whining and crying about this. I believe with a perfect faith that I'll come through it. And I believe with a perfect faith that I'll come through it a better person and more compassionate and more empathetic to the people around me and their wants, needs, and expectations. So,
well, Mitch, thank you for sharing the start of your world as it comes to being, you know, such a great contributor and an author in our industry. Thank you very much for being so transparent and sharing your current challenge, which I kind of feel that you're set up to overcome. And what I'd love to do, God, wouldn't it be cool to, you know, do another interview while you're in isolation just because we can?
If I'm able, I will. You have
so,
my word on.
So how about this? You know, you reach out to me through email when you think that, wow, I feel great today. Let's do something and let's keep this thing going because, there's a lot of, I've got right in front of me here, only a dozen questions that I wanted to get to that we haven't, but that's okay because we got more to do.
Well, you got 13 then, because be sure and ask about the book.
That was there. You know, maybe you could, let's cover that before we leave. Misfire is the name of the book. There's so many people in the industry that have written books or they're somewhere in a certain stage of writing. When do you believe Misfire is going to be published?
Well, we got interest from two publishers, which we didn't expect to have.
Oh, great.
So we're going through that process right now. And, we're really excited because we're going to self-publish if we don't have sufficient interest from a publisher for them to take the reins of that process, then we're going to self-publish and get the book out there. I think it's worthwhile. I think it's an allegory. It's written more as a novel with lessons embedded in it for those people in our industry. I think it'll resonate not only for people in our industry, but for any small business owner. The two central characters are a shop owner and a general contractor. It represents a lifetime of learning and my very odd philosophical take on life in any business and lessons I learned in martial arts and in many other places along the way. So I think it's a spiritual book. It's a practical book. It's a how-to book, and it's a great story. I think it's a great story.
Mitch and I were talking previously, and he kind of helped me understand, that he had some character development that he worked on, and he figured out the flow and the balance of the book. I mean, these are author things that are above my pay grade, but I'm so happy to hear that you're ready to push the button.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a legacy. It's a legacy item, and I got to get better because I want to write the sequel.
Yeah, well, that's cool. So as we're going to do some more interviews and cover some of these, maybe we can get more in depth on the book the next time.
That'd be awesome. I mean, I've really enjoyed this, Carm. I mean, it's thank you for the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
Thanks, Mitch. You've made my day and probably my year.
Well, you've really... you've helped me. We just got through the last hurdle, the last test, which was the angiogram yesterday and the bone marrow biopsy 2 days before that. This is the last hurdle before the process begins. And you've really, you've given me a lot to think about and a lot to feel very, very positive about. And, you know, keep doing what you're doing because it's important. We all have our ministries. I found mine in print. You've got yours here.
Yeah.
It's critically important because if we whisper in the industry's ear long enough, who knows, they might listen.
Yeah, I know. You know, you're writing about the business of our industry and we're talking about the business in our industry. And, you know, Mitch, I know, no different than me, where people come up to me when I'm out there thanking me for, oh, it was this episode that turned me around or I discovered the podcast and I became a viral listener, and it really helped me and my husband or us and our team. And those are just the warm stories. And you've probably had thousands of those in your life. And so I know how you feel.
I think we're both very fortunate in the respect that we've impacted so many people and on a number of different levels. And it's nice to know that you're making a difference, that you're not just taking up space on the planet.
Yeah, I know. Isn't it so true? We have our purposes, and yours is yet to be done. And we'll look for part two of Mitch soon. Thanks for being here, man.
Coming to someplace near you soon.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.